His appointment was for 9 o'clock. He hated that, not because of the time. 9 o'clock was halfway through the morning for most of the Manhattan business community. The hour was not upsetting him. It was the fact that he had an appointment at all. It was a very long time indeed since Chester Stone had made an appointment to see anybody. In fact, he couldn't accurately recall ever making an appointment to see anybody. Maybe his grandfather had in the very early days. Since then, it had always worked the other way around. All three Chester Stones, be it first, second, or third, had secretaries who graciously tried to fit supplicants into a busy schedule. Many times people had waited days for a provisional window, and then hours in an anteroom. But now, it was different, and it was burning him up. He was early because he was anxious. He had spent 40 minutes in his office reviewing his options. He had none. Whichever way he cut it, he was $1.1 million and 6 weeks short of success, and that was choking him too. Because it wasn't a spectacular crash and burn, not a total disaster. It was a measured and realistic response to the market that was almost all the way there, but not quite. Like a heroic drive off the tee that lands an inch short of the green, very, very close, but not close enough. 9 o'clock in the morning, the World Trade Center on its own is the sixth largest city in New York State. Bigger than Albany, only 16 acres of land, but a daytime population of 130,000 people. Chester Stone felt like most of them were swirling around him as he stood in the plaza. His grandfather would have been standing in the Hudson River. Chester himself had watched from his own office window as the landfill inched out into the water and the giant towers had risen from the dry riverbed. He checked his watch and went inside, took an elevator to the 88th floor and stepped out into a quiet, deserted corridor. The ceiling was low and the space was narrow. There were locked doors leading into offices. They had small, rectangular, wired glass portholes set off center. He found the right door and glanced through the glass and pressed the buzzer. The lock clicked back, and he went inside to a reception area. It looked like a normal office suite, surprisingly ordinary. There was a brass and oak counter, an attempt at opulence, and a male receptionist sitting behind it. He paused and straightened his back and stepped over towards him. "Chester Stone," he said firmly. "I've got a 9 o'clock with Mr. Hobie." The male receptionist was the first surprise. He had expected a woman. The second surprise was that he was shown straight in. He was not kept waiting. He had expected to sit for a spell out there in reception, in an uncomfortable chair. That's how he would have done it. If some desperate person was coming to him for a last-ditch loan, he'd have let him sweat for 20 minutes. Surely that was an elementary psychological move. The inner office was very large. Walls had been removed. It was dark. One wall was all windows, but they were covered with vertical blinds, open no more than narrow slits. There was a big desk. Facing it were three sofas completing a square. There were lap tables at each end of each sofa. A huge square coffee table in the middle, brass and glass, standing on a rug. The whole thing looked like a living room display in a store window. There was a man behind the desk. Stone started the long walk in towards him. He dodged between the sofas and crabbed around the coffee table, approached the desk, stuck out his right hand. "Mr. Hobie," he said, "I'm Chester Stone." The man behind the desk was burned. He had scar tissue all the way down one side of his face. It was scaly, like a reptile's skin. Stone stared away from it in horror, but he was still seeing it in the corner of his eye. It was textured like an overcooked chicken's foot, but it was unnaturally pink. There was no hair growing where it ran up over the scalp. Then there were crude tufts, shading into proper hair on the other side. The hair was gray. The scars were hard and lumpy, but the skin on the unburned side was soft and lined. The guy was maybe 50 or 55. He was sitting there, his chair pushed in close to the desk, his hands down in his lap. Stone was standing, forcing himself not to look away, his right hand stuck out over the desk. It was a very awkward moment. There is nothing more awkward than standing there, ready to shake hands while the gesture is ignored. Foolish to keep standing there like that, but somehow worse to pull your hand back. So he kept it extended, waiting. Then the man moved. He used his left hand to push back from the desk, brought his right hand up to meet Stone's, but it wasn't a hand. It was a glittering metal hook.
CD 2
Tripwire by Lee Child. It started way up under his cuff, not an artificial hand, not a clever prosthetic device, just a simple hook, the shape of a capital letter J, forged from shiny stainless steel and polished like a sculpture. Stone nearly went to grasp it anyway, but then he pulled back and froze. The man smiled a brief, generous smile with the mobile half of his face, like it meant nothing to him at all.
"They call me Hook Hobie," he said.
He sat there with his face rigid and the hook held up like an object for examination. Stone swallowed and tried to recover his composure, wondered if he should offer his left hand instead. He knew some people did that. His great-uncle had had a stroke. The last 10 years of his life, he always shook left-handed.
"Take a seat," Hook Hobie said.
Stone nodded gratefully and backed away, sat on the end of the sofa. It put him sideways on, but he was happy just to be doing something. Hobie looked at him and laid his arm on the desktop. The hook hit the wood with a quiet metallic sound.
"You want to borrow money," he said.
The burn side of his face did not move at all. It was thick and hard like a crocodile's back. Stone felt his stomach going acid, and he looked straight down at the coffee table. Then he nodded and ran his palms over the knees of his trousers, nodded again, and tried to remember his script.
"I need to bridge a gap," he said. "6 weeks, $1.1 million.
"Bank?" Hobie asked. Stone stared at the floor. The tabletop was glass, and there was a patterned rug under it. He shrugged wisely, as if he was including 100 fine points of arcane business strategy in a single gesture, communicating with a man he wouldn't dream of insulting by suggesting he was in any way ignorant of any of them.
"I prefer not to," he said. "We have an existing loan package, of course, but I beat them down to a hell of a favorable rate, based on the premise that it was all fixed amount, fixed term stuff, with no rolling component. You'll appreciate that I don't want to upset those arrangements for such a trivial amount."
Hobie moved his right arm. The hook dragged over the wood.
"Bullshit, Mr. Stone," he said quietly.
Stone made no reply. He was listening to the hook.
"Were you in the service?"
Hobie asked him.
"Excuse me? Were you drafted?"
"Vietnam."
Stone swallowed. The burns and the hook.
"I missed out," he said. "Deferred. For college. I was very keen to go, of course, but the war was over by the time I graduated."
Hobie nodded slowly.
"I went," he said. "And one of the things I learned over there was the value of intelligence gathering. It's a lesson I apply in my business."
There was silence in the dark office. Stone nodded, moved his head and stared at the edge of the desk, changed the script.
"Okay," he said. "Can't blame me for trying to put a brave face on it, right?"
"You're in relatively deep shit," Hobie said. "You're actually paying your bank top points, and they'll say no to any further funds, but you're doing a reasonably good job of digging yourself out from under. You're nearly out of the woods."
"Nearly," Stone agreed. "6 weeks and $1.1 million away is all."
"I specialize," Hobie said. "Everybody specializes. My arena's case is exactly like yours. Fundamentally sound enterprises with temporary and limited exposure problems. Problems that can't be solved by the banks because they specialize too in other arenas, such as being dumb and unimaginative as shit.
He moved the hook again, scraping it across the yoke.
My charges are reasonable, he said. I'm not a loan shark. We're not talking about hundreds of percent interest here. I could see my way to advancing you 1.1, say, 6% to cover the 6 weeks.
Stone ran his palms over his thighs again. 6% for 6 weeks, equivalent to an annual rate of what? Nearly 52%. Borrow $1.1 million now, pay it all back, plus $66,000 in interest 6 weeks from now. $11,000 a week. Not quite a loan shark's terms, not too far away either, but at least the guy was saying yes.
What about security? Stone asked.
I'll take an equity position, Hobie said.
Stone forced himself to raise his head and look at him. He figured this was some kind of a test. He swallowed hard, figured he was so close, honesty was the best policy.
The stock's worth nothing, he said quietly.
Hobie nodded his terrible head like he was pleased with the reply.
Right now it isn't, he said, but it will be worth something soon, right?
Only after your exposure is terminated, Stone said. Catch 22, right? The stock only goes back up after I repay you, when I'm out of the woods.
So I'll benefit then, Hobie said. I'm not talking about a temporary transfer. I'm going to take an equity position and I'm going to keep it.
Keep it, Stone said. He couldn't keep the surprise out of his voice. 52% interest and a gift of stock?
I always do, Hobie said. It's a sentimental thing. I like to have a little part of all the businesses I help. Most people are glad to make the arrangement.
Stone swallowed, looked away, examined his options, shrugged.
Sure, he said. I guess that's okay.
Hobie reached to his left and rolled open a drawer, pulled out a printed form, slid it across to the front of the desk.
I prepared this, he said.
Stone crouched forward off the sofa and picked it up. It was a loan agreement, 1.1 million, 6 weeks, 6%, and a standard stock transfer protocol. For a chunk that was worth $1 million not long ago, and might be again very soon. He blinked.
Can't do it any other way, Hobie said. Like I told you, I specialize. I know this corner of the market. You won't get better anyplace else. Fact is, you won't get a damn thing anyplace else.
Hobie was 6 feet away behind the desk, but Stone felt he was right next to him on the sofa with his awful face jammed in his and the glittering hook ripping through his guts. He nodded, just a faint, silent movement of his head, and went into his coat for his fat Mont Blanc fountain pen, stretched forward and signed in both places against the cold, hard glass of the coffee table. Hobie watched him and nodded in turn.
I assume you want the money in your operating account, he asked, where the other banks won't see it.
Stone nodded again in a daze.
That would be good, he said.
Hobie made a note.
It'll be there in an hour.
Thank you,
Stone said. It seemed appropriate.
So now I'm the one who's exposed, Hobie said. 6 weeks, no real security. Not a nice feeling at all.
There won't be a problem, Stone said, looking down.
Hobie nodded.
I'm sure there won't, he said.
He leaned forward and pressed the intercom in front of him. Stone heard a buzzer sounding faintly outside in the anteroom.
The Stone dossier, please,
Hobie said into the microphone. There was silence for a moment, and then the door opened. The male receptionist walked over to the desk. He was carrying a thin green file. He bent and placed it in front of Hobie, walked back out and closed the door quietly. Hobie used his hook to push the file over to the front edge of the desk.
Take a look, he said.
Stone crouched forward and took the file, opened it up.
There were photographs in it. Several big 8x10s in glossy black and white. The first photograph was of his own house, clearly taken from inside a car stopped at the end of his driveway. The second was of his wife, Marilyn, shot with a long lens as she walked in the flower garden. The third was of Marilyn coming out of her beauty parlor in town, a grainy, long-lens image. Covert, like a surveillance photograph. The fourth picture was a close-up of the license plate of her BMW.